We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn, sitting in for David Inge. In Two Rivers, Wisconsin, a museum is bringing together people with knowledge of an old craft and artists and art students of the digital age in the pursuit of graphic design, cultural preservation, and along the way, economic development. Two Rivers is a town of 13,000 people located in northeastern Wisconsin, about 3 hours north of Chicago. It is proud of its history, and it's trying to build a future. The Hamilton Woodtype Museum was once a factory where workers made wood type one block at a time for use in printing. Today, that's been replaced by a computer process, and polymer, not wood, is the medium. The story of Two Rivers, the Hamilton Wood Type Museum, and the renewed interest in wood letter forms and the letterpress is the subject of the documentary Typeface. Typeface will be screened this evening at 7 o'clock in the Parkland College Theater. Doors open at 6:30. General admission is $5. Proceeds will benefit the Parkland Art Gallery. Our guests this morning are the filmmaker and two area graphic designers. They are filmmaker Justine Nagin of Cartemquin Films, Paul Young, associate professor in the graphic design program at Parkland College, and graphic designer Paula Popowski, a board member of the Champaign Design Organization. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guests. Join us with a phone call. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And we're unable to take email questions this morning, so sorry about that. Good to see the three of you. Thank you so much for coming in today. What an exciting project this is. I didn't know much about type and typeface, so I went to the library and I got a book, and I love the title, Stop Stealing Sheep. Long story, we won't go into it. But the authors said, this was very interesting, they compared type to a voice. And being a radio person, I thought, I can get that. In the author's words, it is the visible language linking writer and reader. So I would like the three of you to share some thoughts with us this morning about the importance of type in our world. Justine, you want to start?
Sure. It's something that I thought about a lot over the course of making the film. And I think, you know, one of the characters in the film says it's the fundamental building blocks of written communication. And I think the book that you talked about, comparing it with a voice, is really true, that a type communicates basic fundamental elements, but yet it can have a personality, it can have a different style, and whether it's big or small or bold or what the actual visual elements of the letters, it conveys something unique about the content of the word.
Paul?
Well, every grad student program needs to teach typography, and at Parkland College we have two classes, Typography 1 and 2. And the reason we need two is because, it's such a big topic. It really needs to be split into two semesters. We first teach students to appreciate typography as a shape, as a an object that you can use to do artwork with, self-expression. You can colorize, texturize, etc. The second half of Typography 2, we teach students how to use type for readability. Most people aren't aware that typography even exists, because when they're reading, type is almost invisible. Mm-hmm. It's the writer's voice, the content that comes through. You have to really study how type is set, the width of the type, the line spacing. Even the subtle change between, let's say, a sans serif or serif font could actually affect the character of what you're reading. So that's why I think typography is very important for graphic designers to know.
Yeah. Paula?
Yeah, I think I don't have all that much to add to what they've said, but I think it's also very important to be aware of the history of type as you're choosing a type for a project, because you can unconsciously convey certain values that were behind the creation of that type. And, you know, if you use, for example, a medieval font for something that's contemporary, you're promoting certain values that might jar with your message. So,
yeah. So maybe we could think of a movie poster, and we could say if it was about vampires, we want a certain kind of type. If it's about typeface, what kinds of choices did you make?
We really wanted to balance both the historical and the contemporary. And so in our logo, we used a sans serif and a serif font. And for those of you that don't know the difference, the serif is the little, and Paul might be able to describe it better, but the little extra ornamentation. I don't know how else to describe it.
Oh, we call it feet.
Thank you. Little feet on the letters. Perfect. Ask the expert. Anyway, but with our logo and the font choices we were making, we really wanted to say this is a film about the past meeting the present and about really having a dialogue about where the future of this historical craft is going.
Yeah. Well, describe the letter T, serif, and...
Yeah, the T is a probably a very good choice to study because everyone can picture what a capital T might look like. In a sans serif situation, it's a horizontal line and a vertical line that sort of meet. The expression, if you're driving along, you know, you meet a T, which means that the street has dead ended. Usually these horizontal vertical strokes are pretty much equal in weight. Sometimes the vertical stroke is a little bit wider and thicker than the horizontal stroke. Now, in a sans serif or more traditional typeface, and sans serifs, I'm sorry, I have to rephrase that. Serifs, okay, are the original typefaces that were designed in the 14th, 15th century, starting even with Gutenberg's days. The popular style of that time had little feet on the letters, and it wasn't until the late 1800s that the style started to change and sans serifs became popular and available. So in describing the serif T, we have to imagine that in addition to the horizontal vertical strokes, at the bottom of the vertical stroke, you have to add another horizontal stroke, a thinner one. Sometimes it's curved, but it's definitely there. And some designers also like to add thin vertical strokes to the ends of the top of the T. Mm-hmm. So depending on the style, you get some very different kinds of styles looking like a T.
Yeah, okay. We've got a listener who would like to talk with us this morning, so we're going to take a call. Line 4, good morning.
Yes, good morning. My question is fairly simple. You described this as wood print block, wood printing techniques. I was wondering, what sort of wood did you use to stand up to the pressure of all the pressings?
You should come see the film and find out more. But initially, John Edward Hamilton, when he started the Hamilton Wood Type Factory, actually used Hollywood. Mm. It was what was local and available. And he was actually before worked in a clothespin factory and got a job, a side job, to print a big poster for a grand ball in Two Rivers. And so this started him on his journey, and he used Hollywood. And actually now and for the bulk of the Hamilton Wood Type Factory's success, I believe it was mostly maple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Holly would have been better, but I can understand maple. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. That caller actually happens to be a woodworker, I know, because he calls fairly often, and he will tell us sometimes a little about wood. So it's very interesting, and I would suggest that he go to Two Rivers and see this museum. So the museum was once a factory. The business was started by, as you mentioned, Justine, James Hamilton in the 1880s, and it was hugely successful. Wood type was big business. How big?
It was huge. I mean, he was able to overtake his competitors on both coasts and in New York, these big type houses. It was a classic American capitalist story. But he, you know, it was the Industrial Revolution. Posters were huge. You had to attract people to your message, whether it was to get on, you know, your train or to come and get a job in the city. But these big, bold letters were important, and that's where wood type came in.
Okay, because you couldn't use metal.
That's correct. Metal, as it got larger and larger, would get too heavy in order to use for printing. And it was advertising art that demanded larger headlines, bigger typefaces, more stylized typefaces, which is why Wood became popular. And a little bit of a tidbit about, and to answer further the caller's question about how wood might not last in terms of making multiple impressions. These days, there's still a few letterpress print shops that actually use wood type around the country, and the newer fonts or the newer typefaces that are just being cut are too clean and too sharp, and they don't like them. It's after the nicks and the scratches get on the type by overuse over and over again that the flaws of the type, of the wood, actually begin showing that it has the wood type feel, and that has value today.
Hmm. When did Hamilton get out of the business of type?
That is a good question. I mean, Hamilton continued to, I mean, it still produces wood type in a very limited basis today. But as the printing industry changed, you know, demand just significantly decreased. And it, I believe in the film, it says in the middle of the 1980s, it finally stopped commercial production of wood type. But as I said, they do occasional special order typefaces for enthusiasts across the country.
Describe Two Rivers, Wisconsin for us.
So Two Rivers is this quaint town on the shores of Lake Michigan. It's between Door County and Milwaukee. It's near Manitowoc. It's right on the lake, and it's filled with a lot of really kind, hardworking people. It's very Midwestern, very Wisconsin. But it's a post-industrial town. You know, it used to be filled with factories. Miro Aluminum was there, in addition to Hamilton. And it's a town, like many of the rural towns in America today, that are trying to reinvent itself and find a new route to economic prosperity and a different identity in today's contemporary time.
And tell us a little bit about Jim Van Lannen.
Sure. Jim Van Lannen is the founder of the museum, and he was someone who we met pretty early on during our visits to Two Rivers. And his enthusiasm is just infectious. He has this field of dreams kind of mentality, and he really wanted to bring people to this town that he was proud of. He owns a hotel on the shores of the lake. He was a businessman, and he has started all of these little museums in Two Rivers. He's currently working on a farm museum and has been all over the Midwest cultivating this excellent collection of agricultural equipment. But he started the type museum. You know, he saw the potential there. He made a deal for the building that houses the museum. He helped staff it. He's on the Two Rivers Historical Society board, and he's really a visionary. I found him very inspiring to talk to throughout my time there.
Yeah. At the end of this film, you're really rooting for wood type and for Two Rivers, the community. The two of you, Paula and Paul, have you been to Two Rivers? Have you been to the museum?
No, I haven't, unfortunately.
You got to put it on your
itinerary. Absolutely, yeah, my next road trip.
This summer, for sure, I'm going up.
Okay. Justine, tell us about some of the other people who are featured in the film from Two Rivers. I'm thinking of a fellow who spent many years making wood type, Norb. Norb Brilski, is that his name?
That is his name, and he is definitely one of the movie stars of the film. We were going to make T-shirts that said I Heart Norb because people just really love him, both in the town and on the screen. He really has a great presence. And he is part of the old guard. You know, he is. He doesn't consider himself an artist or a craftsman. He considers himself a worker bee. You know, he was a foreman in the factory, and he still goes in. He's in his 80s, and he goes in and cuts type on these, antique machines now. But he's opinionated. He's very friendly and very, very funny. And for any of you that come out to the film tonight, you will surely appreciate seeing Norb on the screen.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about the program at Parkland. And are you using this older technology, or by and large, are you computer and polymer?
We are completely computer, and we have to be to stay current with today's technology. As graphic designers training to be graphic designers today, when they finish the degrees and they want to start working as a graphic designer, They have to pretty much enter their first job ready to work. They have to be really comfortable on the computer. They have to know the software applications. They have to understand visual communication, design principles, and be very resourceful and creative as well. However, I do teach graphic design history. And every now and then, I get an opportunity to do a field trip. And one of the field trips that I've done twice now is 2 hours away in Idaville, Indiana, is a little letterpress print shop called Tribune Showprint. They sort of market themselves as the oldest continuously running letterpress print shop in the United States. Similar to the Hatch Showprint in Nashville, they're actually 1 year older than them. And this Idaville town has literally maybe 100, 150 people. There's absolutely nothing there, maybe a railroad track and a railroad crossing, no lights. And they're in this warehouse, and no one really knows they're there. They're actually kind of lonely. They welcome visitors. The people that work there and the owner, Beth, inherited this business from her father, and I'm sure that it's a family business that goes way back when. But she's not a graphic designer. She's not a typographer, and she wasn't trained as a printer. She just knows what her parents taught her. And they stay in business today by printing reproductions of souvenir posters, boxing, maybe a jazz singer that needs to have the letterpress wood type look. So they do it authentically with wood type, using letterpress, but of course they're printing posters for shows that happened maybe 50 years ago.
Hmm. Paula, what's the appeal of this for you as a graphic designer? Have you gotten your hands into wood press?
No. We are looking into maybe working with Soybean Press here in town and trying to maybe organize a workshop through Kudo. But unfortunately, there isn't enough of a volunteer base to make that happen yet. But I guess the appeal is to understand more about the history of my chosen profession, and it's just an art form. It's just I think you lose something when you don't get to physically touch an object and to make things happen. So the more you know about printing and about the medium, then the richer your work will be.
Yeah. Kudo, by the way, is the Champaign-Urbana Design Organization, and
yes.
And Paula Popowski is a graphic designer, and she's a board member of Kudo. Also with us this morning, Paul Young, associate professor in the graphic design program at Parkland College, and filmmaker Justine Nagin of Cartumquin Films. This is Focus. I'm Celeste Quinn, sitting in for David Inge. The story that we're talking about here this morning is told in a new documentary called Typeface. It is the story of Two Rivers, Wisconsin, the Hamilton Wood Type Museum, and the renewed interest in wood letter forms and the letterpress. That is the subject of the documentary Typeface. It will be screened this evening at 7 o'clock in the Parkland College Theater. The doors open at 6:30. General admission is $5, and proceeds will benefit the Parkland Art Gallery. Listeners, you can join us this morning with a telephone call. Questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And our apologies, we cannot take email questions this morning. Justine, there are a number of young artists featured in the film, and one of them is, her name escapes me right at the moment,
Stacy Stern.
And she described this way of printing as luscious. What is she talking about?
I think, again, it goes back to what Paula was talking about the tactility. And there's this theory right now that as we sit at our computer screens all day, in the off hours, we want things we can hold in our hands. So some people think it's why knitting is popular again, or why people are playing guitar, or, you know, what have you. And that actually that tactility and sensuality, if you will, is very attractive. And especially to people who primarily live their lives in this very flat digital space. And the lusciousness, you know, a lot of letterpress stuff is printed on really gorgeous paper, and the ink is thick and goopy, and there's just this real, tactile quality about printing, and we really tried to capture that in the film.
Yeah. There's also a professor of graphic design from Purdue featured, and one of the things that struck me about what he had to say was that by giving students that tactile experience, they understand letters and spaces, spaces around print, spaces within letters. Paula, can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, you know, as someone who entered the field once computers were the norm, I know that it's very easy to lose sight of why certain conventions exist in printed design. And you tend to think of it as a science sometimes. You think of the printing process as a science, but it's not. And that's something that you don't realize once you start entering the field and working with printers and presses, whether letterpress or otherwise. And I think that just being physically involved in studying these type forms and in person can only help to emphasize that.
Yeah, Paul? Yeah.
Well, I entered the profession before there were computers, so although I didn't work with metal type or wood type, I do remember in my college days using press type. Once again, it's rub down letter one at a time, so you have to make a decision as to how close the second letter is to the first letter and how close the third letter is to the second letter, which means you have to use your eyes. You have to think. You have to make judgment calls. And you also make mistakes, which means you have to do it all over. And mistakes, I think, are the best teacher. Mm-hmm. So, and we have to, and we do try to do this in the classroom as well, using the computers. So we ask students to take a letter form and make it into a shape, an object that can move around the screen, that they can rotate, they can flip, look at upside down. In fact, one of the first exercises we ask students to do in Typography 1 is to do a self-portrait using only shapes from a letter form. That way they get to see, okay, this particular letter might actually work as an eye or a nose or an ear. So begin to recognize letters as shapes is an important part of the learning process.
One of the things that Dennis talks about in the film is having that tactile experience makes you slow down. And when I learned film, I learned on 16mm, and it was a similar experience. Like, if I wanted to make an edit, that splice and taping it and, you know, cutting it again. And every decision, you know, I had to take a minute, really think about it, how much I was invested in that choice. And I think that process made me a better video editor eventually and now a filmmaker because I process that information differently and it made me slow down.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I grew up with reel-to-reel tape and a China marker and a razor blade. And it made me very aware of breaths and silences, which is really important in telling stories. And I my younger colleagues are marvelous storytellers and they do a terrific job, but it's a very different way of approaching the business of telling a story.
And I think as we move forward, and one of the things we want to raise in the film is as our visual and media culture moves forward, finding places to step back and slow down and take those breaths and really think about what's important in the story for all the kids that are going to be learning radio or design or film in a very hyper-fast way, you know, trying to figure out ways for them to step back.
Yeah. Paula, what led you into this line of work? And once you started studying it, you must have been maybe felt a little overwhelmed because when you step back and you think of typeface, we're surrounded. It's everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, and the more you learn about it, the more you become aware of it. Now it's sometimes crossing the street takes a half an hour because I keep looking at the signs and it's quite distracting, especially at the beginning. But I entered the field I studied art history in college and I worked for museums and art galleries for a few years in the Bay Area, and I had a series of jobs that eventually led me to being the assistant director of an art gallery in San Francisco. And while I was working there, one of my jobs became to maintain the website and to take care of all of the marketing materials for the gallery. And I found more and more that as my day went on, that was the thing that I was looking forward to doing. It seemed like a natural progression when we moved over here to switch to that career, because I could draw on my art background and be able to do something creative that contributes to my community as well.
Paul, what led you into the field?
I wanted to be an architecture when I was in high school, so that was my first love. Oh. And as I look back, I see a similarity between graphic design and architecture. We're both professions, we're designers. We plan a lot. We take usability into account when we make decisions. Both professions are also visual. I mean, building is not only an environment you can enter, but a building also has to look a certain way to be a contemporary building or a building of a certain style. What I discovered was that you can actually make money easier in graphic design, so the choice was obvious when I started to enter college.
Yeah. Well, you've got art, craft, precision, all similar in both fields. Justine, there's a group in the film from Chicago that calls itself the Post Family. And these three designers have very long and demanding day jobs in design, yet at the end of the day, they're in their studio with the letterpress. What do they have to say about why they're into this?
I think for them, it's both. They like the intellectual and creative challenge of working with design in a totally different space and environment and with a different community of people and a different energy. I mean, we shoot in one of their day jobs and then at their studio at night to kind of contrast that, to show, you know, the day job, they all have headphones on, they're listening to their music, they're at their computer. It's a very kind of quiet, zen, professional environment. And then at the presses are clanking and there's, you know, communal music playing and people are chatting and it's a much more social environment. And so I think that's part of what attracts them. I think also there's this kind of general nostalgia right now for analog media. You know, people are listening to music on their iPods, but they're not getting rid of their LPs. You know, Saturday was Independent Record Store Day. You know, there's still that that appeal. And so I think that's part of it, too, kind of a sentiment. I wouldn't say that they're sentimental, far from it, but that there's an interest kind of in older ways of doing things.
Yeah, what is the demand for this kind of print material?
I'll let Paul or Paula speak to it a little bit more, but there is huge demand from rock posters to art prints to independent craft fairs right now. I think there's a resurgence for sure.
There is, and there's another documentary film called American Artifact that was released perhaps a year ago or so that sort of documents the history of the poster. And at a certain point, do-it-yourself movement came to be, and even going to Kinko's to do Xeroxes and paste-up became cool again for bands who needed instant self-promotion. Silk screening is also coming, having a resurgence. Mm-hmm. Just to give Paula some credit here, the promotion material for Champagne's premiere of the film Typeface was all designed by her, and in addition to doing the typical printed posters, she also hand silkscreened a limited run edition of the same design. And that poster will be available for sale tonight at the premiere. How many copies did you end up printing?
20.
Mm-hmm.
And where very did you, small
very
run.
Limited run, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And where did you print this?
We printed it at Weisskamp. They were incredibly generous with their time and their equipment. They're just such a wonderful resource for the community. We really appreciate all of the help that they've given Kudo in the past year.
Well, Paula, you designed the promotional materials for the screening in Champaign-Urbana. How did you begin to think of the problem that was before you? What did you want to do with promoting the film typeface?
Well, as a designer, I tend to be very literal sometimes. Sometimes the literal solution is best. So I sought to use type as an illustration. And I just started playing around with different typefaces and trying to make a clear and just make a clear message out of type, but using it in an unexpected way.
Okay. And what does the silkscreen poster look like? Can you give us a little bit of an idea of what it looks like?
Well, it's a three-color poster, and it features poplar standard, which I believe is a wood type that you got from the Indiana letterpress.
Right, Tribune Show Print. That's right. It's an actual authentic wood typeface design.
And it creates a it covers the entire surface of the poster with type. Used in unexpected ways.
Yeah. It looks like modern art if you look at it. So it's got the nostalgia of the old typeface design, and it's got a very contemporary, abstract, geometric shape kind of a feel.
Yeah, I did look at a lot of constructivist paintings as inspiration. I'm a big fan of the Dada movement, so that was also unconsciously on my mind as I was making it. So I think there's just a lot of jumbled up input.
And I would encourage people to go online and to Google typeface movie, and you'll get right to your site, Justine. Tell us about, here you've got a film about a very old craft and art, and you're putting it on the computer, you're putting it online for us to see. What kind of problems were there for you, and how did you address those problems?
First of all, we worked with some good people, which I think is key to solving any of those problems. Kartemquin is fortunate enough to work with a pair of young designers that go by the name Dizzy Giant. They're a pair of brothers, Dan and Matt Sharkey. And we had some early meetings about how to kind of attack the past, present, future problems inherent with the film and the site, and wanting it to be a very dynamic site and very usable site. The graphic design community is very, for the most part, very tech savvy and very, I don't want to say demanding, but we knew that the site would be under both pressure as far as it needed to look good, but it also needed to be very functional. And so what we did is we have a site that, has video on it. It has still images on it. It has a place that you can donate to the film. It has a store with some beautiful, beautiful limited edition prints that other artists have made to support the film. And what we tried to do is, in the design of the site, convey some of the parts, some of what Paul was talking about earlier, some of the elements of wood type that is attractive, and some of the beauty and tactility that's in the museum by just having a ton of photos. And right on the front when you get there, the site is typefacethefilm.com. There's an image of a printing press, a short video clip, and I think for people it's really attracted them and pulled them right in from the beginning.
Yeah, and there's this kind of vintage feel at the same time. So you've got, and the press itself is vintage. So I don't know, it's a wonderful combination of contemporary and old world, if you will. Well, I want to go back to the idea of typeface and share with our listeners a little bit more about what this thing is. How many are there? And, and do designers continue to develop new typefaces?
There are too many typefaces, in my opinion. And these days, anyone can make a font if they wanted to just by the right software, and then they can publish it, and many do. And if you Google free fonts, you're going to get hits, and there'll be 10,000 typefaces you can download for free. Not all of them are going to be of quality. There are a few free ones that I think I've used that are really innovative and really different than anything I've seen. But most of them are very amateurish. So in addition to drawing the right shapes with letter forms, a font designer also has to take into account technical aspects such as kerning pairs. If you can think of, let's say, a capital T next to, let's say, a lowercase a, the capital T on the right-hand side has a negative space, and there's going to be a hole there unless the font designer handles how the next letter is juxtaposed against the capital T. Professional font designers spend hours, if not days, okay, on managing how these pairs of letter forms will look when they're put next to each other. So if you buy a font from a manufacturer such as ITC, International Typeface Corporation, or Adobe, for example, they're going to be very professionally drawn and professionally, technically kerned properly. So the two letters that have trouble being next to each other are accommodated. I love fonts. And when we teach typography or we teach graphic design at Parkin College, I hide 90% of fonts that are on the computer and offer to the students only a very short list. And the list is designed to have them study the classic fonts first before they go on and explore all these crazy newfangled fonts that are coming out. The classic fonts will solve 90% of visual communication problems. And classic fonts, I specifically call them classic fonts because they've been in use for hundreds and hundreds of years, and they still haven't gone out of style yet. So it's unlikely they're going to go out of style in the near future.
Yeah. I like Times Roman. I wonder why. Why do we gravitate toward one particular kind of thing in our correspondence or in our writing?
Right. Well, it is a classic font, meaning it's been around since the 1700s. Times Roman, historically, was actually custom created for the Times of London. So it was extremely readable typeface invented for a newspaper publication. Times Roman also, thanks to Microsoft, was a default font in Microsoft Word for many, many years. So it was Microsoft's way of saying, well, what is the most clean, readable serif typeface we can use so people don't have to make any choices when they begin typing a document? And I think they chose correctly. Times Roman is a really good, very neutral-looking font.
Yeah, I find it very clear and crisp. Now, other people have other, tastes. Can you tell us anything about the choices that people are making? Because now you can pull down on your computer. You can pull down, I don't know how many. And people like to go with something a little out there. Why is that?
Well, I think we touched a little bit about on this in the beginning. Type conveys messages. So people seek to find just the right font for whatever message they're trying to convey. Right now, I'm noticing that there's a very large trend towards fonts that look like they were handmade or scripted. So you're seeing a lot of fonts with flourishes, very retro fonts are being used. With, as always, these things come and go. So what's fashionable today may not be fashionable in a year from now, even. So.
Well, I'm thinking now of, and I can't remember his name, but he is the author of a number of very popular books for young readers. Diary of a Wimpy Kid. And the font that is used in that is like a young person's handwriting printing, although it's a font. And there was an interview that he gave on All Things Considered, and actually some student somewhere, a young reader of his, asked him, is this a font or do you actually write this? And I thought, wow, that kid is really on top of it. So there's another example of what's appropriate to how you're telling a story and who your audience is.
I think, too, that the final medium that the work that you're making is going to be displayed in, that there were fonts that were designed for posters, there were fonts that were designed for books, and now that a lot of stuff is being read on the computer screen, it's changed also the kind of fonts people are choosing. Graphic designers that are working primarily for the web may choose different typefaces than those that work primarily in print.
Yeah. And if I'm recalling correctly, back in the day when there was a print shop on every corner and people were making wood typeface, there were critics. There were people who said, that's terrible, right? Is that correct, Justine?
That the work itself was terrible?
Yeah, there's an art to this. And, you know, some people looked at Hamilton and said, this stuff is not the best. And
you know how it goes. Any new thing that comes in, yeah, it's I think the old guard always critiques it. And I think with wood type, it was designed for posters. You had to catch people's attention. So there were a lot of crazy forms, you know, H's that didn't look like H's and, you know, K's that didn't look like K's. And I think that sort of change in aesthetics makes, you know, sometimes makes people uncomfortable, and also legibility. Like if you can't read something, it's a huge disadvantage.
Yeah. Also, it seemed like there was criticism over, you know, it was like all these things were shouting at you, but that was the way to get your message out, was to be bigger and brighter and bolder than the poster, the billboard that you were up against, right, next to.
Yeah, there was a time in the 1800s when wood type was very, very popular, and all these print shops were, of course, competing with each other, and they tried to produce the posters as fast as possible. And you, in addition to choosing the right typeface for a poster, after the poster is printed, you have to take the typeface back and put it back in the case so that it can be used again for the next poster. If you didn't have enough letters of a particular font, then you can't spell all the words that are necessary for a particular poster. Mm. So when a poster layout artist ran out of certain letters of certain fonts, they would just pick another font. And if they ran out of letters for that font, they would pick another font. So you end up with a poster that might have 7, 8, 9, 10 different fonts. And that's what caused the critics, I think, to start to react and say, God, this is so chaotic. There's no thought to it. And they're right. There wasn't, because they were in a hurry. They ran out of fonts.
Yeah. Well, there are a couple of men in the film who are in the print business today, and they grew up in the business, the Moran brothers. They have a business called Blink in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and one of them talks about how he started in the business by cleaning up after.
Yes, Jim talks about working with his father and about having to sort through all those little pieces of metal type and put them away based on, you know, punctuation, and how those little tiny characters, you know, he blames his bad eyesight on that now. But Jim Moran and Bill Moran both are very invested in the museum and have brought a lot of new energy. Bill Moran takes groups of students to various type museums around Europe. There's one in Italy, one in Germany, and he's really embraced this idea of giving students opportunities to interact with the old technology.
Let's take a call, a listener on line one in waiting for us. Good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. I print, edit a botanical newsletter, and I wonder your opinion on a good typeface. I had been using Times, and I got some complaint that it was not as readable as it might be, and I switched to, I think it's Palatino Linotype.
Okay.
But what would you use?
Yeah, both Times and Palatino are beautiful, classic serif fonts that have been used for hundreds of years, and they all have slightly different character to them, but both are extremely readable. I'm very surprised by the complaint that you got in terms of readability of Times Roman. There may be other issues. It could be line spacing. It could be the width of your columns that's causing readability issues. I think it comes down to personal taste. If you do use a classic font, a font that's been around for a long time, there's a good chance that when you compose your page, it will be very readable. So I'm not sure it's going to be a choice of font that's going to be a major problem. It's how you typeset the columns of type that could be improved.
I'm using two columns mm-hmm. and 10-point print.
Okay. If you switch to three columns, I think maybe 10% of your audience will suddenly say, hey, that's more readable, because you now have fewer words per line.
Mm-hmm.
And these studies actually say the optimum number of words per line should be about 7 words. You don't have to adhere to that, but it's a sort of a goal that you can try to achieve.
That makes sense. But you would, like, I still use times for letter writing,
mm-hmm.
but you would find the Palatino quite acceptable.
Yes, Palatino, I would say, has a more modern look than Times. Mm-hmm. Times is a little bit more traditional than Palatino. You might want to consider maybe Garamond or Century as other alternatives. So the best way to do it is to typeset it in 4 different fonts, print it mm-hmm. out, spread it on the table, and look at all 4 different fonts and find which one feels best to you.
Of course, some of the issues are printed with a laser printer, and some of them go out as PDF files. And it was the PDFs that seemed to be drawing some criticism. Hmm. And I suppose it with different word processors, the fonts may actually vary a bit. I'm using one of the newest versions of WordPerfect.
Okay. I think most software will handle the fonts properly.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more the decisions you make as you compose the page, how wide, how large, how much line spacing, etc. PDFs, I usually, in my experience, have not gotten any complaints, particularly when someone receives a PDF. They have the option of zooming in and enlarging it. So if anyone's having trouble reading a PDF, all they really need to do is hit the plus sign, and all of a sudden, the type's larger.
Well, for my part, I like PDF for that very reason. I'm not sure all my readers realize they can do that.
Well, in that case, they can always hit the print button, and then they can lay on the couch and be by the window where the sun comes in and relax and read the document then.
It's a wonderful age, isn't it?
Yes,
well,
it is.
Well, thanks.
Thanks,
so much.
Thanks for the call. This morning, this is Focus. I'm Celeste Quinn, sitting in for David Inge. We're talking about type and typeface this morning. We're also along the way talking about a community in northeastern Wisconsin, a community of 13,000 people. It is home to the Hamilton Wood Type Museum, which was once a factory where workers made wood type one block at a time for use in printing. Today, that, of course, has been replaced by a computer process. But anyway, the story of Two Rivers, the Hamilton Wood Type Museum, and the renewed interest in wood letter forms and the letterpress is the subject of the documentary Typeface. It will be screened this evening at 7 o'clock in the Parkland College Theater. Doors open at 6:30. General admission is $5. Proceeds will benefit the Parkland Art Gallery. We have 3 guests with us this morning. Graphic designer Paul Young, who is an associate professor in the graphic design program at Parkland College, is with us. Graphic designer Paula Popowski, a board member of the Champaign-Urbana Design Organization, is with us. She designed the promotional materials for the screening of Typeface in Champaign-Urbana. And the filmmaker, Justine Nagin of Cartemquin Films, is with us as well. Again, my name is Celeste Quinn. We have about 5 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us, give us a call, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. And we have another caller waiting for us on line 1. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I'm calling from Urbana. Within the last week or so, there is a news story about...
Oh, I'm afraid we're going to have to ask you to turn your radio down. And we'll come back to you in just a moment. In the meantime, I'm going to ask Justine a little bit more about Two Rivers and the museum. How are things going there these days?
Things are going well. I don't want to give away too much of the film, but there is some real positive momentum in the town. I think people have rallied behind the museum And I think the film has helped raise awareness. And from the people that are running the museum now, there's a lot of exciting stuff happening. They have a membership program. They have a website, woodtype.org, if you want to check it out. And a lot of activity, people printing, workshops, students coming in and interning and helping clean and organize. A lot of really good things happening.
And you had a couple of screenings of Typeface in Two Rivers. What was the response from the townspeople?
We have. At Kartemquin Films, we always show our main characters the films before they're done to get their feedback. And it's not to, I don't know, it's not to have them, you know, check off on every little thing, but that the overall film that they can stand behind. And so they had seen it, the main characters in the film had seen it prior to the Two Rivers premiere. But we had a wonderful premiere at the Washington House, which is an, has an old ballroom, and many of the town came out, a lot of elderly people, residents of the town. And I think it was interesting for them to see themselves on screen, but overall the reaction was very, very positive. And I think it started a real dialogue with the Historical Society and with the town about what to focus on moving forward.
Okay, let's go back to our caller. Listener line one, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank
you. Okay, sure. Go ahead.
On the news a couple of weeks ago on NPR, there's a story about universities exploring changing font to save printer costs or printing costs.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
What was the name of that font?
What did they end up picking? I can't remember what. Mark Simonson is the guy's name who they interviewed, and he's out of Minnesota. I bet he has it on his blog if you Google his name. But I cannot remember what they decided used the least amount of ink for printing. But that, I thought that was a great piece.
It was like 20 to 30% less ink.
It was amazing.
Well, thanks for the call this morning. We're coming down on time. What else should we talk about? I know what I wanted to talk about. You know, the new way we can read a book, we can read it on a Kindle or some other readers. Is that making a difference in how designers are in the publishing game are looking at typeface? Paul?
Well, I have not specifically designed for the Kindle, but I believe, if I understand correctly, the people who designed the Kindle were trying their best to imitate what it would be like to read a book without having paper. So I think instead of font designers or graphic designers working towards designing for the digital, new digital media, digital readers, the digital readers are being designed to be get the reading experience of paper as much as possible.
Yeah, but I wonder if some fonts would work better in that medium than other fonts.
I'm sure they've done a lot of studies. Yeah, I'm sure.
Okay. Kartemquin Films production. You want to tell us a little bit about this outfit, because it's a really great outfit. You've been around for a long time and you've done some great films. Tell us what your mission is.
Sure, I'm happy to talk about it. Kartemquin Films is a 44-year-old social issue documentary company based in Chicago. Typeface is just one of a handful of recent releases. We have a film right now on ESPN called No Crossover. It's playing throughout the week, and we have a number of new films that'll be out next year. We really try to put a human face on today's social issues. And in Typeface, we really looked at art in society and kind of the future of post-industrial towns. And in many of our films, whether they're films about stem cell research, genetic testing, aging, race in America, we really try to find a human way in. And Kartemquin, Hoop Dreams is our most famous film.
Sure. And we've got a local connection there.
Oh, yes.
Yes, Mr. Marks.
That is right. And, yeah, Frederick is now living out in the Bay Area. But Hoop Dreams is a piece we're very proud of. And I invite the listeners to check out our website, kartemquin.com, to see other films of interest. Most of our pieces are available on Netflix and iTunes as well.
Okay, and there we have to wrap it up. My thanks to my guests this morning. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.